From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, another twist in the Les Moonves saga could sink the former CBS executive's chance for a multi-million dollar severance. Then, when the actress who plays the mom in Alfonso Cuarón's movie Roma went in for an audition, she wasn't told who the director was, and they didn't even talk about the role.
The only thing I had to do was sit down and talk about my life, how my childhood was, who were my parents, not really about my job or my life as an actress, but my life as a person.
And we ask a pop music critic what makes for a good holiday song. All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Netflix, presenting an original film from Academy Awards winning directors Joel and Ethan Coen, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, an exploration of life's joys and woes set in the American frontier. Awards eligible on Netflix and in select theaters.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. In 1995, Bobby Phillips was a 25-year-old actress with some small film and TV roles under her belt. Her talent manager, Marv Dower, arranged a meeting for Phillips with Les Moonves, then the president of Warner Brothers Television. Phillips told the New York Times that while meeting with Moonves in his office, he forced her to perform oral sex on him. When a phone call interrupted the assault, she fled. After that, Phillips said she was afraid to meet with studio executives alone, and auditions gave her anxiety attacks. Her career faltered, and she left the business in 2003. But in recent years, Phillips started acting again and reconnected with her former manager, Marv Dower. Last year, when a New York Times reporter called Dower to ask about allegations of sexual assault involving Les Moonves, then the head of CBS, Dower contacted Moonves right away. James Stewart is a columnist at the New York Times. He's been reporting this story. He explained Dower's relationship with Moonves as it stood last year.
He had not actually spoken to Les Moonves in years. And they were, in a way that, I mean, Hollywood people, I think, understand, and others probably not so well. In the food chain out there, Moonves is at the pinnacle, and Marv is pretty far down and slipping. Moonves would not take a call from somebody like Marv Dower. But all of a sudden, Marv Dower sends him an email saying, "Les, urgent, I've got to speak to you." And 10 seconds later, Moonves is on the phone.
Because Bobby Phillips has told Marv Dower what happened, correct?
Yes. Bobby Phillips told him something about it when it actually happened, which was in 1995. Enough that he knew that it had been some kind of sexual assault and it had been terrible. Because at the time, Moonves came back and said, "Oh, you know, we love her. We want to set her up with producers." Marv Dower conveyed that what he thought was the great news to Bobby Phillips. And she said, "Don't let him near me. I will never work for him. I will never speak to him again. I will never work for any network that he's connected to." Which was, you know, for an aspiring young actress to say that about one of the most powerful people in the entertainment industry was pretty revealing. And then he'd been getting calls from the media. He got calls from the New York Times, and he got a call from Deadline Hollywood, specifically asking about Moonves and Bobby Phillips, because Bobby Phillips had told the story over the years to friends. Some of them were now talking.
There's a quote from Les Moonves that Marv Dower attributes to him in your story, and it's, quote, "If Bobby talks, I'm finished." So why is what happened between Ms. Phillips and Les Moonves so worrisome to Moonves if he has said that it was consensual?
Well, that has been his defense for all of the women who have come forward with allegations. And in his first actual statement about it, which was to a CBS lawyer last January, Moonves said that he had exposed himself and she had run out of the room. He did not say who this person was. When pressed by the lawyers, he said, "Oh, well, we had oral sex and it was consensual." But right there, if it was consensual, why did she run out of the room? I mean, that made no sense from the get-go. Then there's all the corroborating testimony from people who spoke to her at the time, and the very significant fact that she said immediately after this incident that she would never work with him again in any capacity.
A lot of the reporting about Harvey Weinstein has focused on how he allegedly bought the silence of his accusers by offering them parts, threatening their careers if they talked, or using financial settlements that prevented the women from talking in exchange for money. And two women who spoke to The New Yorker said that Moonves also threatened to derail their careers. But this is almost a twist on all of this, that Moonves and Dower are essentially trying to buy the silence of an alleged victim by commissions to her talent manager. Do I have that right?
That's correct. I mean, the way this was framed by Moonves, he didn't threaten or anything, and there was nothing explicitly about a quid pro quo here. But when you read the text messages, it's perfectly clear that the talent manager, he maintains he was just trying to help both sides. He's trying to help Moonves keep this quiet. He's trying to help his actress get new work. And, of course, by the way, he was going to get a cut of whatever she was paid, so he was helping himself as well. But the way this was framed is, according to the manager, Moonves said to her, I want your forgiveness. I want to atone for what happened. And one way for me to do this is to give you work. She initially said, well, no, you know, I'm retired. I don't want to work. I don't want to do this. But she was open to the possibility, the more she thought about it, that maybe it would help her heal if she was able to come to closure here and find some way to forgive him, and maybe a part would be part. That's how it was all sort of set up. Well, eventually, when The New Yorker came out initially with six other women accusing him, she thought she was the only victim. She thought she was the only person that was involved and that he was genuinely trying to atone. And she suddenly realized that the whole thing was an attempt to keep her quiet, to shut her up, to buy her off. And she was furious.
There's also reporting that Moonves directed Dower to delete text messages, and that Moonves himself deleted text messages that could be damaging to him. How could that affect his potential $120 million severance payment from CBS?
Well, this is a critical element in the severance payment, because to get that money, if he's fired without cause, he gets the money. If he's fired for cause, he does not get the money. The cause in these contracts and in his contract is very narrowly defined. It's clearly stated in his contract that he, quote, must cooperate fully, unquote, with any CBS internal investigation. And for him, first of all, Dower himself told me on the record and has told the CBS lawyers that he was instructed by Moonves to delete all of these text messages, to erase them. Moonves has denied that. Moonves himself deleted the text. Everyone concedes that's the case. His lawyers claim that he deleted text in the ordinary course of business. But even beyond that, did he ever tell the CBS investigators, oh, by the way, there are hundreds of texts that spell out this entire situation, and although I deleted them, you should know what were in them? No, he never said that. He claimed he only spoke to Dower, I think, five or six times, and that they had minimal contact. In fact, there are hundreds of these text messages going back and forth between them starting last December.
James Stewart is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He is a columnist at The New York Times, and along with Rachel Abrams and Ellen Gabler, the author of the article, If Bobby Talks, I'm Finished, How Les Moonves Tried to Silence an Accuser. Coming up, two actresses talk about auditioning for Alfonso Cuarón's Roma without knowing a single thing about the project. A couple of weeks ago, as Roma was coming out in theaters, Alfonso Cuarón talked with us about how he dove deep into his childhood memories to recreate a traumatic year in the life of his family for the film. Cuarón's mother and especially his nanny are at the center of Roma. The mother character, Sofia, is played by the Mexican actress Marina de Tavira, and the nanny, called Cleo in the film, is played by first-time actress Yalitza Aparicio. I had the chance to meet both of them at the Telluride Film Festival, where Roma was shown. They were joined by Yalitza's translator, Gabriela Murga.
Marina and Yalitza, welcome to the show.
Gracias. Thank you. Thank you. We're really happy to be here.
Marina, I want to start with you about how you heard about this project and the first conversations you had with Alfonso Cuarón about being in the film.
Sure. Well, I was called for an audition for a movie, and they didn't tell me who the director was. And it was not an audition like any other, because the only thing I had to do was sit down and talk about my life. Whatever I wanted to say about my life, how my childhood was, who were my parents, not really about my job or my life as an actress, but most my life as a person. And then I didn't hear about them like for months. And then one day they called me, they wanted to see me again. I still didn't know who the director was. And then I went again, they gave me a little scene and to memorize right in that moment. I did it, and in the end they told me it was a movie that was going to be directed by Alfonso Cuarón. So my heart really stopped there. And they told me that they were gonna, if they called me before 12 at night, I will be meeting Alfonso the next day. And if they didn't call, I wouldn't be meeting Alfonso the next day. So I was like really anxious, trying not to look at the phone at all to see the what hour it was. And then it was 12 at night and they hadn't called. So I said, okay. But 10 minutes later, they called. So I got to meet Alfonso the next day and we worked on a scene. And then I didn't hear again of them for 1 month. And then one day they call me again that they were going to take pictures of me with some clothes. So I went there and that's the day I met Yalitza. She was there. They left us together for a long time. We had a conversation. And then they started putting clothes on us, taking pictures. And at the end of that session, Alfonso sat with the two of us and he said that he wanted to invite both of us to a movie that was very special for him and that he hoped that we had the time to do it and that we were able and happy to do it. And well, it was really a moment I will never forget.
Yalitza, unlike Marina, you hadn't done a lot of acting. How did you find out about this movie? What was your first contact from Alfonso Cuarón about being in Roma?
Bueno, realmente no he hecho nada para el cine. Yo no estudié para actuación ni nada de esto.
I've never done anything in the movie industry before at all. Actually, I've never studied to become an actress or anything at all. I just graduated to become a teacher there where I live in Tlaxiaco, in Oaxaca. Actually, I went to the casting because my sister wanted to know what a casting was all about, but I didn't have a clue and I just went. And once I was there, after I did what they told me, they said, okay, if we like what you did, we will call you, we'll keep in touch. Then they called me and I was supposed to go to Oaxaca, to the capital of the state, but my parents said, no way. We don't trust these people. We don't know who they are. We don't know what's the purpose. You're not going. And well, then finally my mom said, okay, I'll go with you. She went with me. After that, they called me and asked me to go to Mexico. My parents again said, no way. But well, in the end again, my mom, they were allowed me to bring my mom with me. And I did. And I didn't have a clue who Alfonso Cuarón was. Not a clue. So I started looking up him on the internet, but just the pictures. I just saw the pictures. Once I got to the casting place, I did the casting. I went through the casting process. And what I liked is that he spoke to me as if he knew me from a long time ago. So I trusted. And he asked me to have peace of mind and to take it easy. And he said, just do what you normally do. And that was my casting process.
Yalitza, even if you didn't know who Alfonso Cuarón was, did you know who your co-star was? Had you ever seen any of her acting? And do you remember the first time that you met her in making this movie?
No, tampoco conocía nada de ella.
No, not at all. I guess I'm kind of far from all this. So the first time I saw her and I met her was right at the casting place. And well, I was told I was going to be there for my last test of the casting. And so I was there and I was expecting to maybe see arriving girls that would look like me. But instead, I saw her arriving. And as you can see, she's beautiful. She's tall. She's white skin and she's thin. And I didn't have a clue who she was. But we greeted each other. Then we were left there alone for a while. And we started chatting about where we were from and whatever. I don't really know if that was a strategy of Alfonso Cuarón to find out on our chemistry or anything, but that's how it happened.
This is a movie that is very personal to Alfonso Cuarón and his childhood and his growing up. And yet both of you as actors have experiences that in some ways are very familiar to what Alfonso went through. So how much of your own story, of your own history, were you able to bring to the character, even though it's based on people that Alfonso knew himself very well?
Well, quite a lot. And I started discovering this while I was playing Sofia and during the filming process. I was born in the early 70s. And in the early 80s, my mother went to a similar process as Sofia, in a society quite the same. In a moment in where for a woman to be left by her husband was like really hard. And all this started coming to me while I was playing Sofia. Memories started arriving, and I had to go to a process of my own childhood while I was filming, remembering the day my father left, the day they told us when I have a brother and a sister, and the day my mother told us that he was leaving. And so at the end, I think that as this is really personal for Alfonso, but in some way it gets really personal to all the people that were involved and to the people that see the film.
Sí, es cierto, es una película muy personal de él, pero lo que él muestra en esa película ha pasado en muchos hogares.
Well, it's true. This is a very, very personal movie for Alfonso, but what he shows in this, what he shows us in this movie, has happened in many, many households, many homes, like mine. My case is similar. In this case, my mom, that is the example I always follow, she is very alike to the nanny that I play. She also takes care of her own family, but she takes care of that family and they feels they are their family. And she takes care of the children just as she would take care of us the same way. Now, speaking about when the scene where the baby situation happens, well, I went through something very similar because of my sister's situation. Thanks God, my nephew is fine. But the process was very, very tough, and I did go through something exactly like that.
Were you gonna add something? Yeah, sure, go ahead.
The magical thing is that I don't think Alfonso really knew about all these personal references, because they didn't ask us that during the audition process.
Yeah, Lisa, this movie is set at a time when there are a lot of things that are going badly in Mexico. The PRI government is cracking down on dissidents. There's protests where protesters are being massacred. And there are a lot of people from states like Oaxaca who are coming into Mexico City to work, you know, in homes as domestic workers. Even though you weren't alive in that period of Mexican history, how has Mexico changed for the better, or how has it remained the same in terms of problems with class and people with money taking away land from people who don't have money?
Bueno, a mi punto de vista, yo creo que no ha cambiado mucho.
I believe it has not changed a lot. I can say that still today we continue to suffer according to our gender, according to the color of our skin, according to the social class, because that determines who you are, what is the place you are supposed to be in, and the opportunities you are given.
Con respecto a lo de las tierras.
Now, speaking about the land situation, it's the same still today. And this is because there's people who do not know their own rights. They don't know how to take care of their land. And we have these politicians, at least in my community, normally those who come and take these lands are politicians. And the sad part is they come and take the land to destroy it, while the people of my community would like to protect nature that they have in their lands.
Marina, Yalitza, Gabriela, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. A beautiful interview.
Muchas gracias.
Roma is in limited theaters now. It debuts on Netflix on December 14th. Coming up, some of the best of this year's crop of Christmas songs.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix original film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. From the incomparable minds of Joel and Ethan Coen comes a six-part anthology film, original stories that only they could tell. Set against the harsh and unforgiving backdrop of the American frontier, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is an exploration of life's joys and woes. Winner of the best screenplay at the Venice Film Festival, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, on Netflix and now playing in select theaters.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. It is that time of year again when Andy Williams, Bing Crosby, and Brenda Lee take over the airwaves. Christmas music is everywhere. But instead of rehashing the classics, we decided to take a look at some new holiday music that's come out this year. Randy Lewis, a pop music writer for the LA Times, recently compiled a list of his favorite Christmas albums of 2018. When we spoke this morning, I asked him what qualities make for a good Yuletide album.
What I look for each year, and I've been doing this for 24 years now at the LA Times, is I just look for a fresh idea, a fresh sound, because to hear another version of Silver Bells or White Christmas, it's going to take a lot to make it stand out from what has been done a thousand times in the past.
And it seems like artists have two basic choices. One, reinterpret an old chestnut, you know, give it some new orchestration, new voice, new melodies, or write a new song and hope that it can somehow become maybe not part of the Christmas canon, but at least a holiday staple.
Well, that's kind of the goal and the roll of the dice is that if you do get one of those, you know, Paul McCartney has Wonderful Christmas Time, Elton John Step Into Christmas, John Lennon and Yoko Ono, the Happy Christmas song, they have become perennials, and it's a lifetime revenue stream.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Absolutely. And if you get an album that sticks, then, you know, people are buying it every year.
I want to play one of the original songs from this year. It's called Bring Me Love, and it's by John Legend.
I don't need my stocking filled with toys, but I don't need no gifts to bring me joy. Baby, I haven't hung my mistletoe, 'cause without you, baby, I can't see no point. Baby,
what do you think of this song?
I like this one. It's he's really tapped into the Motown, you know, spirit in this one, and wrote it with Meghan Trainor and a couple of other people.
I want to play an example of a new rendition of an old Christmas song. I'm not going to tell anybody who it is, but I suspect some people can spot it.
Feliz Navidad! Feliz Navidad! Feliz Navidad! Prospero Año y Felicidad!
It's William Shatner, and William Shatner, and I think we're going to talk about this in a more positive light, his performance of Rocket Man, probably one of the greatest spoken word slash song reinterpretations of a song I've ever heard. But William Shatner apparently has a Christmas album, and he's doing Feliz Navidad.
Whoever thought that the final frontier would turn out to be Christmas music?
And you like it, right?
I like it. Again, he approaches these things. He admits, you know, he can't sing a note. So how do you go into Christmas music and try to interpret it spoken word? And half of his solution is bringing in a bunch of guest musicians, and the diversity is pretty impressive. It's Judy Collins to Iggy Pop, Brad Paisley, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top. So he's got all these people. So you've got a musical component there. But then he speaks these things and tries to find the narrative, the theatrical quality. And of course, it's typical Shatner over-the-top narrative. So, you know, anybody who's a Shatner fan is going to get a kick out of this.
I want to play another song. It's called Santa Will Find You by Shelley Wright.
If you're listening for reindeer and sleigh bells as they jingle and tap on the roof, you're awake piled in blankets with your cousins at grandma's, and you hope they'll be...
It's really lovely.
It's a very sweet song. I got to know it from a version that Mindy Smith did at least a decade ago, and actually recorded it before Shelley Wright, who wrote it. And other people have latched onto it since. But this is the first time Shelley Wright's gotten around to recording holiday music of her own. And I find that this is a great example of how to do something different with Christmas music. It's this, you know, very touching idea that, you know, wherever you are, this spirit of Christmas, Santa will find you. And I found it very heartwarming.
Now, we've talked a lot about Christmas songs. Are there other songs that are appropriate for the holidays that are not about Christmas?
Sure. There's all sorts of songs that sort of, you know, mention the season, talk about winter, brotherhood, humanity, goodwill. So there's a lot of different attitudes and subjects that don't specifically get into Christmas itself.
You listen to, I'm sure, stacks of Christmas albums. I think there's one that you are really fond of by J.D. McPherson called Ugly Sweater Blues.
Ugly Sweater Blues is part of this record that J.D. McPherson and his band put out called Socks, a Christmas album. And I just think it's over-the-top great. They recorded it like a vintage jump blues R&B band from late 40s, early 50s. They got the sound down, the style, and it's a blast.
Mama, don't make me wear that old thing again. Hand-knitted Christmas trees and a silly snowman. No matter if I refuse, I got them ugly sweater blues.
It's kind of if Paul Simon met Perry Como, I think.
I said the record's like what Louis Prima or Roy Brown would have done if they ever got around to making a Christmas album.
Randy Lewis is a pop music writer at the LA Times. Randy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, John.
Maybe you heard the news. I got the ugly sweater blues.
And that is the show for today. Remember that The Frame has a weekly newsletter. It goes out every Thursday. It's a great way to keep up with the show and news from the world of culture. You could sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Drive into Atlanta.